Today, more questions and answers, or the third baby and bathwater out the window.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
So when we first introduced this, it's not really a series. I mean, let's be honest. It's just a theme that fits how I have come across these topics, having received questions in some cases from listeners or friends or just fellow Christians who've had some kind of connection with me and therefore were curious what I thought about this or that topic. And in dealing with these particular kinds of questions, having an understanding that it's complicated and that very often people might understand the basic concept, but not really the underlying realities or issues that were going on more significantly with these topics. And so I've wanted to bring some of those up. And part of it, the baby and bathwater idea, is that in adopting a certain perspective and answer to these questions, there has also been a hesitancy to go all in on it because of what we're afraid we're going to lose in the process, or sometimes an unwillingness to accept something that's true because of what inherently goes with it, hence the difficulty of separating one thing from another. And so I'll get further into that as we go through this one. So, we've talked about already, and again, a lot of these are kind of personal because in my experience of developing a certain understanding of a concept or an issue, I've gone through the transitions that made it difficult for me to accept part without embracing the other. And so the examples I've given are like that. They're personal. So tests of Christianity was the first example that we gave. And the next part, the revolutions of change that we talked about last time, these were just things that it took me a long time to come to understand and that I find valuable when people can come along and understand what's actually transpiring with them as well. And so the third one, the one I want to talk about today, has really to do with just how broad the scope of pain is in other people's lives. It manifests itself in a lot of different things. I'll start with the example of sexual abuse. And because I'm starting on that topic, I'll also start out by saying I'm not going to get graphic about any of this or try to drag you through the mud with any of the details or anything like that. So I don't think you would have to be nervous. For instance, if you are a parent listening with a child around, but it is painful. So I mean, we are dealing with the scope of pain. So it's not like there's nothing negative there. But I think there is a reluctance for us to deal with this as transparently or as thoroughly as we ought to, for the reasons that we're talking about in this series, that it forces us to do some things we might not want to do in the process. So in talking about the scope of pain, I just want to use sexual abuse as the first example and then use a couple of other examples to try to clarify what I actually mean by all of this. So sexual abuse, let's first of all just get it in context, in our purview, in our sight, right? So let me use some statistics to start the conversation, just so you get a sense of how broad, again, how thoroughly ensconced in our society this problem is. We like to think of it as just, it's a little thing way over there in the corner, in that part of society, or those people experience it. but it's a lot more incorporated into our lives than we think. So I took these numbers from the National Center for Victims of Crime, victimsofcrime.org. You can go look it up and see a lot of the other details of how these numbers are arrived at, or other numbers based on other ways of looking at it. But these are child sexual abuse statistics that they're not for, it's not the first time I've heard them, and numbers tend to hover around this range in my experience. So the prevalence, this is a quotation from them, the prevalence of child sexual abuse is difficult to determine. I'm quoting the website now, but I affirm this from my own experience. It's difficult to determine because it is often not reported. Experts agree that the incidence is far greater than what is reported to authorities, which ought to trouble us when I read to you this one example of a statistic that I want to give you, that when you interview people about it over the course of their lifetime, 28% of U.S. youth ages 14 to 17 had been sexually victimized. That is, if you just ask them at some point, have you been victimized during that period? 28% of the 14 to 17-year-olds who were asked this question looked back and said, yes, I have been sexually victimized. That's more than one in four U.S. youth who answered the question that way. And there is a likelihood that that's underreported. Somewhere between one in four and one in three is underreported, because you can imagine that you have to trust the person you're reporting it to, so the person asking the question. And in a survey, it's extremely likely that there are some of those youth who are saying, I'm not going to tell you. Why would I tell you? Or I'm going to go back and get in the car with the person who's abusing me. I'm not going to tell the truth about it right now. There are a bunch of reasons that it might be underreported. So just think about that. One in four of the youth who are around us. And I know what we want to think is, oh, well, not in my context, because I'm in a church setting. It's not different in church. It's not different as you go throughout the society. So the idea that one in four, somewhere between that, one in four and one in three of these youth have been victimized, tells you we need to think about this. We need to be aware of it. And the question is, why on earth wouldn't we? Why wouldn't we be talking about this every day? And I know part of the reason is simple. It's just too painful. You can't constantly stare at something that's horrifying and not be desensitized by it or driven away from it. So I understand we can't do it every day. We can't handle it if we have to deal with it every day. But this is worse than not just handling it every day. This is not wanting to see it at all, burying our heads in the sand and not talking about it at all. And I think there are quite a few reasons that that could be happening, that we can overlook it or neglect it, or also quite a few reasons that it could be underreported. So let me give you an example of one reason that it might be underreported and that we're just not choosing to think about it. And it goes along with part of the nature of our culture. And it's just it's a historical part of our culture that none of us can get away from. And it's present everywhere. It's not just some little select group of people that I'm talking about here. But it's part of the cost of having a moralistic, sort of puritanical culture when it comes to our sexual mores, our norms, and what we find acceptable to discuss about sexuality in our culture. It's really easy to understand how we could incline ourselves to be that way about sexuality. You know, and when I say that way, I mean we don't like for it to be front and center in our lives. It's really weird. We have a sort of self-contradictory culture in this regard, because if you go outside of the Western world, you know, people look at us. If you think about Islamic cultures, for instance, they look at us, and it's our sexual depravity that makes them hate us so much. And when I say they, I don't mean the individuals. I'm not saying every Muslim hates the West. But I mean there are cultural expressions of disdain for the sexual depravity that's in the West. It's not hard to figure out why. Watch a TV show or watch a movie or listen to the music. And, you know, it's pretty explicit. And even the regular stuff, just the things that get a PG rating or whatever, really sort of push the boundaries a lot of times in those ways. And we go and watch it. We are just devouring it, consuming it in our society. It's weird that we're that way on one side. And I don't mean demographically one side. I mean that way on one side of our personality. And obviously there are extremes. There are people who don't ever see any of that stuff and have it all wiped out of their family and house and everything else and would never, ever indulge in something like that. And there are people who are libertine to the extreme. You know, I know they're the extremes. But in the middle, we're sort of bifurcated within ourselves about what we're doing. On one side, going and seeing all the movies and watching all the TV shows and listening to all the songs that talk about it constantly, sexuality, constantly. And then on the other side, we don't want to talk about it at all with our friends, with our family. We don't want to bring it up. We don't want to talk about sexual education. We don't want to read a book about it. It's like, that's too private. I don't want to have to deal with that. That weirdness in our culture is in some ways a little, you know, it's not that difficult to understand. The reason we fall into the kind of moralistic, puritanical restrictions that say that's for behind closed doors, we don't want to deal with that at all, is that there are sexual norms in Scripture that don't go away just because our culture changes over time. There are things we're supposed to realize are inappropriate outside of the sexual relationship that's had in marriage. So fine. I'm in agreement with that. I don't have any problem with that. I acknowledge the traditional nature of it and so on. But there is a downside to that, which comes back with a vengeance in our culture and some of the media expressions and things like that, that doesn't mean that only a small section of our society has this sort of awkwardness about sexual conversations and things like that. It doesn't mean that. It doesn't mean, oh, those bunch of prudes that go to church, they're the ones who have this problem. If you just think about it, a lot of think back to the 80s, 90s, whenever it was that Footloose came out as a movie. It's a perfect expression or example of this. It's not like the movie was sexually libertine and the idea of puritanical, thinkers in that culture were foreign to it. The whole nature of the movie is that the conflict is being brought to bear. You know, there are all these prudish people who won't even let their kids dance. And then there's the dance where it's a little pushy, you know, whatever. But we're going to cut loose and dance, you know, and we're going to break that's that whole confrontation is a revelation that we have a little bit of both of that in our culture constantly, and that even the people who are favoring the libertine side of it, you know, let's cut loose, are still heavily influenced by that sexual restriction that comes with the Puritans and that part of the background of our culture. There's no getting away from it. And unfortunately, part of the side effect of that, and I do mean unfortunately, again, I'm not against having sexual mores or norms that are fixed, that where we say, you know, this is appropriate, that's inappropriate. I'm not comfortable with sexual conversations. I'm uncomfortable with how many times I've said the word sexual in this episode. I'm blushing about it. So I'm the worst of these. But I realize that there is an extremely negative consequence that comes with that. If you've grown up your whole life and you say something about sex and you get a frown from a parent or you get a look of discomfort from everyone who's in the room, then when it's time for you to talk about sexual abuse and something that happened to you, ooh, an uncle did something inappropriate, it's very likely, it's very possible that your reaction to that is going to be silence. Oh, I don't want to bring up the topic. I don't want to be embarrassed, and I don't want to embarrass other people with having to talk about this terrible concept. So it's not surprising that in environments sometimes that are the most, giving the most energy to trying to suppress inappropriate sexual behaviors, people might be getting away with the most inappropriate sexual behaviors because nobody's willing to talk about it. I'm not saying that's a universal law or it's what creates the problem. I am saying it makes it understandable why the underreporting might be a part of our society, our setting, and particularly I'm talking about our churches too, that makes it even worse than it ought to be in our setting. So it's possible that that's a part of what's going on, the downside to that kind of moralism being silence, you know, people not being willing to talk about it. But beyond that, there's a problem, you know, that, like, I'll put it in terms of a question myself. You know, why is it that we don't do something to put a permanent stop to sexual abuse once we do find out about it? Why don't we just step up and take all the steps that are necessary to somehow put an end to this kind of problem? And I wish we would. I mean, again, there are settings where people are doing something about it. So I'm not trying to pretend nobody's doing anything. My own church, as I'm recording this, tomorrow will have a sex abuse awareness day where we talk, and prevention day, where we talk about how to make sure this doesn't happen in our setting. And it's good. It is very good. We speak openly about it. We talk about methods and things to say and do, and putting procedures and policies, having them in place, and then enforcing them and so on to keep this from happening. So I'm not saying it's impossible to do anything. You can do something about it. But why don't we do more? And why, after so many decades of awareness, and even just over the last 5 or 6 years, awareness at an even higher level of how pervasive the problem is, why don't we do more to stop it? And the answer is not that complicated. It's because the changes, very often, for anything, by the way, but certainly on this one, the changes that would be required to address the problem would also require a steeper price for us to pay than we're willing to pay. You know, what I was saying a moment ago is sort of a cheap price. Hey, make yourself uncomfortable with a conversation. Be willing to blush when somebody's telling you something without telling them they can't say it. But even that price keeps us from bringing it up. I don't want to be embarrassed by talking about something that's so uncomfortable. Well, there are other prices that are involved with something like this that if you're willing to just confront it and address it, might be more than we want to bring up, might be more than we want to address. I'll come back to some of those or an example or two of what that's about in a minute. But, you know, in my experience, how pervasive this is requires more conversation. We've done episodes on here before with guests where we've talked about how pervasive this problem is. I encourage you to go back and listen to those. But when I, you know, here's how I've experienced, and again, this is more in the vein of these are the things I've figured out over time and that I wish we would be willing to understand in a more nuanced way and a more, in some cases, more confrontational way than we have been. And so part of the thing here is that in my experience, when I share these kinds of concerns in a church context, on a Sunday night or a church where I'm doing an interim or whatever, and I've shared it in quite a few different contexts, the response, and this is, it still does surprise me, but I also expect it. I hope you'll know what I mean by that as I say this. The response is constant. I say it in a church. Look, this is the kind of sexual abuse that's happened. This is the kind of thing that goes on. This is part of the reason that it might be happening, whatever. Somebody comes up to me afterwards and says, well, it happened here. You know, and they tell me the story of when a youth pastor or a pastor or some a deacon or somebody, you know, a Sunday school teacher or somebody else was involved in this. And this is what happened in their church. And this is how long it took to address it. Or it never has been addressed. I don't know. Or, well, you know, that happened to me. And they tell me their personal story of how it happened. That response, one of those responses, it's ubiquitous. I don't know anywhere that it hasn't happened. And you would think, and again, the statistics would bear that out. If 1 in 4 14 to 17-year-olds are saying, yeah, that's happened to me, then we should expect it to be as ubiquitous as it is in that case. And so the question is, well, if we know it's a problem, then why aren't we addressing it? Why aren't we fixing it? And, I'll say up front, partially, and this is so frustrating, partially, it's because we get cornered by our political commitments.
if you adopt the view that the Me Too movement's legitimate, then you must be on the Democrat side or the progressive feminist side of things. And then you can't be a good Republican and you can't vote for the conservatives anymore because, you know, it's, you can't be a part of us. We don't trust you anymore because we know ultimately you're trying to go further. And I'll talk about that further later. Not everybody thinks that by any stretch of the imagination on either side of the political spectrum. But it does happen. I've seen it happen with hordes of people, and it's mind-boggling in the moment. It's like, why on earth wouldn't we want to address this? And it's because it's gotten jumbled up with other political convictions that people are not willing to sacrifice. I understand how that happens. It happens to all of us. That's part of what I'm trying to address in this. Is to see that you don't have to throw out the baby, the thing that is important to you, to get rid of that dirty bathwater that you don't need to keep, that we don't need to keep, including this kind of tolerance of sexual abuse in our midst. So that's part of the reason I think we don't deal with it. But it goes, and here's where I want to just take a break from the sexual abuse talk for a minute and say, this whole underlying issue thing that I'm trying to get at isn't just about sexual abuse. Today, I am trying to use sexual abuse as sort of the model of how pervasive pain is in the lives of people who are around us that we ignore and that they won't bring up with us because they know we're going to ignore it anyway. And so we all just blithely go along as if nothing needs to be done about it. And it's just stunning to me how much more pain there is than we admit, and how many people are carrying that pain without being able to tell anyone about it. And again, it's personal to me because I experience it. I experience what it is to sit down across the table. Well, first of all, I'll do this in three tiers. First of all, just to sit down across the table from someone who is a known sexual abuse survivor and has made that a part of their career or path forward and is trying to get the culture to respond to it. In dealing with someone like that, just hearing their story, the story of pushback against them, the number of names they've been called or accusations that are railed against them as if they're just doing it to be famous or to make a name for themselves is just stunning. But hearing their personal account of what actually happened, just, it can stop you in your tracks and make you think, how could a person have gone through this and us not have cared, not have done something about it as a society or a culture? There's that. And then there are the people who I'm just speaking with and saying, hey, you know, as we're addressing this subject, you know, we need to think about this and that. We need to put this policy in place, this whatever. And to hear someone in that context who we have no idea has gone through anything like this say, well, actually, that's exactly what happened to me. And then tell their story out of the blue, whether they've ever told the story before or not. That makes it even deeper to say, how are we allowing this? How can there be this much pain? But it always gets closer than that. And nobody, if you're listening to this, you don't have to worry, am I going to tell your story? I'm not going to tell your story. I'm not going to tell someone else's story about this. It's yours to tell. I wouldn't do that. But my point is, man, I've had people awfully close to me sit down and just finally at some point say, you know, this happened to me too. And we have to do something. You know, we have to do something better than what we're doing. And part of the reason I'm doing this episode today is to say, we don't even have to come up with all the solutions and all the policies and procedures. There are lots of people who can work on that and people can figure it out. But us recognizing that we don't have to run from it, we don't have to avoid being able to talk about it in order to maintain the things that actually are important to us, which maybe as a culture have kept us from dealing with it as effectively as we should have. So let me give a different example to make the point. So let's take drug abuse as an example, drug addiction as an example. So, and I'm doing this from my personal examples. These are things that have happened with me, with relatives, you know, sort of coattail relatives, or with other people that I knew and encountered this with and went through the journey, you know, at least to some extent with.
So here's an example from my personal journey. So first, there is the discovery that somebody is addicted to drugs. And sort of an immediate, and again, this is just personal experience. I'm not saying any of this is right or wrong. It's just what I went through and what I know other people have gone through too. I've had enough conversations with people to know this is a pretty common element in these journeys. So first of all, you discover, oh, you know, this person's addicted to drugs. Oh, lo and behold, they're buying drugs or they've been using them or they, you know, were found passed out and now they're in a police station or they're in a hospital somewhere, whatever. You find out that someone's a drug, that someone is abusing drugs. Maybe they're addicted to the drugs, whatever's going on. And, you know, the immediate response is just to say, how could they do that? It's personal responsibility, you know, personal accountability. They shouldn't have gotten involved in this. They shouldn't have done this. They need to step up and get right. They need to make the right decisions. And, you know, if you put it most tersely, it would be if you put me in a room with them, I'm going to become Bob Newhart in that skit that everybody knows. You know, I'm just going to do the, did that cause some problems for you? Well, then stop it. You know, just stop it. Don't do it anymore. And I'm gonna give them a lecture and I'm going to show them what they need to change because they just need to step up and do the right thing. So stop it. You know, personal responsibility. And then over time, and I don't know how long, and with me, sometimes it was way too long. But over time, you get a sense, a deeper awareness of what's going on, maybe in that person's background, some underlying causes that have brought them to a point where they needed to do that in their mind, that was the solution, or some background conditions that, you know, at least cause you to say, I kind of understand where they're coming from. It promotes a sense of empathy. And in my experience, that equates to encouraging some therapeutic solutions rather than stop it. You know, you just stop being a sinner, stop being wicked, stop being evil, stop doing stupid things. Instead of that becomes, let's figure out a way to help. You know, we're gonna try to, and I'm making it sound like this is the end. This is just the second step. And so, you know, you try that for a while and say, oh, we're going to put you in therapy. We'll get you into rehab. We'll get you into this center. We'll pay for it. You know, we'll help you. We'll provide a place for you to stay. We'll get you a job. We'll do all the stuff. So you do all the stuff and all of that's going along and you're feeling pretty good about having understood that there was more to this than just a person who stepped off. It's more than just personal responsibility. And then you get the betrayal. Then it is, what? We did all of this and they went back to it? We did all of this and they lied to my face and did exactly what they weren't going to do. Well, I'm telling you what, I'm done with them. They can fix it themselves. It's their fault. They need to make it right. And you can see in the betrayal that I'm right back to personal responsibility is the only thing I'm thinking about. And that, you know, I have no idea how many people have been through that journey and so many iterations of the subpoints of it and to other nuanced points that I didn't bring up. And I have no idea how many people have been through that. I know I've been through it. And it comes with, you know, a realization over time. Now, you know, in my 60s, a realization, I think, and hopefully I had come to this earlier than in my 60s, but I'm not positive I did, that all of those underlying realities through each one of those steps, all of the underlying realities were true still throughout the whole process of my experience. Meaning, while I was experiencing the shock of discovery and thinking, oh, personal responsibility, they need to do it, just stop it, why are you acting like that? Those underlying causes, those background conditions that later in my thinking about it might make me more empathetic, they were already there. They were already provoking, stirring, I don't know, pushing, inviting, enticing, tempting, whatever word you want to put on it. They were already there. And all those conditions, the underlying conditions, the background conditions, all that stuff, they were still there when I'd gotten all the way through the process and back into the betrayal. All of that was still there. My emotions were just feeling different at that particular moment. My point is that I don't need to give up an awareness of the things that made me empathetic in the moments when I'm having all the emotional experiences that don't want me to be empathetic. I can hold on to both. And I'm not pretending that emotionally I can stay there all the time. that I can just be in the, and I'm not pretending that my behaviors aren't going to change. That in a moment of betrayal, I might need to back off of how much help I'm giving a person financially, or if I'm providing rehab for them or something like that. I'm not saying none of that changes. But my awareness that there are still underlying conditions, that there's still something else going on with that person, that there's more than just this simplistic response, doesn't go away. And if you're saying to yourself, oh, you're acting like there's no personal responsibility, no, that's one of the things that is always present. In the moment when I am being empathetic and when I am understanding that there are background conditions that might be bringing this to pass, it doesn't mean I can't look at them and say, and yet you've still got to make your choices. You've still got to make decisions. You've still got to decide it's worth going through this process and so on. The personal responsibility is also still always there. But let me take it out of the world of drug addiction and put it instead into the realm of poverty, just something that happens to some people. Some people are just born into poverty. And by the way, I'm just going to pause for a moment and insert something else that kind of goes with this. When we're in our judgmental, throw them off the cliff, I can't believe they would do that kind of behavior thing with a drug addict, we do tend to reduce them to objects instead of people. They're addicts. They're not even full humans anymore. They're just addicts. So they're an addict. So you can expect them to betray you. And a lot of the descriptions are true. It is true that you can expect that. So we just reduce them to the term addicts. It's a lot of what we do with immigration, where we take a person and instead of saying, well, this person is here undocumented, or this person is here in violation of certain laws, this person is here illegally, we just start calling them illegals. Now they're not even full human beings. They're just illegal things that happen to be present. When we start reducing people like that, we're throwing out the baby with the bathwater. We're throwing out the human being with all of the conditions around them that we do want to address in a way that might be throwing some stuff out the window. I need to get rid of that. I need to get rid of this. But you know what you don't need to get rid of? The human being that's in the middle of that equation. They're not just an illegal and they're not just an addict. They're still a human being. Again, it doesn't mean we don't need to do something. It doesn't mean things don't need to change. But it does mean we don't have to lump everything together into one big pot and throw it out the biggest window we can find. Poverty, use that as an example, and especially I'm using this because the comparison with personal responsibility in this case, you know, you can talk about it in all three of those same ways. The fact that there is personal responsibility, that people are capable of making a difference. And in our particular culture, there are a lot of opportunities. There are ways to change your condition, your status in life. The fact that there is personal responsibility doesn't erase in any way the fact that there are also barriers for the poor that are not the same for the wealthy. And if you say to yourself, well, that's just not true. Anybody has open access to get to anything they want to get to, would make me say to you, then why do you want to put your kids in a better school? Because you want them to have more opportunity than they would have if they were in a lesser school. The idea that poverty doesn't bring with it certain barriers is just nonsensical. But you say, oh, but then you're just saying people aren't responsible for their... I didn't say that at all. The whole point is that the fact that there is personal responsibility doesn't erase the other fact that there are barriers for the poor that are not there for the wealthy. And there are different barriers for the wealthy, by the way. The fact that there are barriers to escaping poverty. So let's say, oh, well, we finally come to the point where we're willing to acknowledge, yeah, maybe there are barriers to escaping poverty. When you're in it, you're likely to stay in it. The fact that's true, that there are barriers that you're willing to acknowledge to escaping poverty, that doesn't erase the things an individual can do to improve their odds or actually maybe possibly even finding their way to success and flourishing. It doesn't completely erase the possibility of taking things into your own hands and making a difference in life. And neither of those two recognitions in balance, neither one, the fact that personal responsibility doesn't erase the barriers and the fact that the barriers don't erase personal responsibility, neither of those balanced recognitions erases the pain inherently present when people are deprived of basic necessities. That's what the meaning of poverty is. That is, when they're impoverished, there is pain that goes with that. And we can maintain an awareness of that without giving up the core values that we hold on one side or the other of the equation there. So in the case of the stuff that we were talking about earlier regarding sexual abuse and some of the gendered things that go with that, a lot of the people, and this is just true, that a lot of the people who do see sexual abuse and pay attention to it and want to address it. And by the way, I'll say this same thing is true about a lot of the people who think women should play a more prominent role in church leadership, that a lot of those people, they also end up being people who advocate against traditional gender roles. I didn't say everyone. I said a lot of times this is what happens. So you'll have, you know, people who are advocating for sex abuse survivors to be given a fair shake, be given a hearing, for their abusers to be held accountable, whatever. That it's not uncommon for the people who are advocating for that also to oppose the broad stereotypes which perpetuate abuse sometimes, you know, the machismo of men and, you know, what ends up being referred to now as a lot of times as toxic masculinity. They can be the same people, and you can see why they might be the same people. They're not always, but they can be. And there are some who would be advocating for eliminating these kinds of sexual abuses and who might be advocating for stronger women, a stronger role for women in leadership in churches. You can see why sometimes they actually do end up advocating for or affirming LGBTQ stuff. That would come up as well. In our school, we are advocating for women to be able to lead in churches in ways that often they're excluded from. But we have a very specific commitment to a doctrine that says only a man can be the senior pastor of a church. I mean, that's a commitment we hold. I hold to that commitment. But it doesn't mean a woman can't teach in this way or that way or be involved in leadership in this way or that way. And we haven't changed our views as a school. I'm talking about Criswell College. Regarding LGBTQ things and issues at all, we have changed our role in dealing kindly with people and loving people and encouraging people. And all of those things are just part of being Christian, but they don't change our doctrine about those issues at all. So I'm not saying it inherently follows that if you care about these things, you are going to go down that road, but it does happen sometimes. And you can see what I'm getting at, that sometimes, because there are some connections between that, people can become so nervous about it that if they hear the term sexual abuse, they're like, oh, no, this is that liberalizing, feminizing, detracting, doctrinally compromised view of the world that's going to lead us down the path to all those things we don't believe in. I understand why people would get nervous about that, because they've seen so many people take a trajectory that's in that direction. But that's not what this is about. That's the point, that we don't have to throw the baby out with the bathwater. And we do need to deal with the bathwater. The shame in all of this backing off and pushing back and doing it and not doing it, is that the underlying pain is still there. People still suffer. Sometimes that suffering leads to further abuse, because it's never dealt with. It's never confronted. It's never approached. No one's held accountable. Sometimes that abuse is caused by other abuse that happened in the past. And sometimes that abuse can embed itself in our psyche, because we never deal with it, in decades that follow the abuse. And often it's there while we're picking a political or a cultural side in the issue. That pain is still there when we're saying, well, I'm not going to talk about that. I don't believe in that Me Too movement because it's a bunch of feminists. When we do that, all we're doing is evidencing that we've picked our political or cultural side to the issue, and the pain is still there. It's still not being dealt with. That happens a ton. So I just kind of want you to understand where I'm coming from on this, not because you need to know, but I just need to say it. But, you know, you might as well know, a lot of what drives the shape of my own influence on things, where I get to give input to things and try to shape things in some way, a lot of what drives the shape of my own influence on those things is just seeing which side of an issue is being neglected and trying to bring it to light for those who thought it ceased to exist simply because it got pushed into the back corner of the closet, or because some social, and what I mean by the back corner of that closet basically is some social or political or denominational or familial sense of belonging and identity. This is not who we are, or this is who we are. That obligation told us, told them to pay attention to that issue, that if we do that, if we pay attention to that issue, we're going to be giving up the things that really matter to us. And sexual abuse is like that. We get duped into thinking that if we really address it, we're going to have to give up some things about humanity that really matter to us. It's not the case, and I've heard this accusation. Well, you know, where did this emergence of sexual abuse happen?
We've done is just talk about it so much that people are just imagining it happening.
It's not the case that there's suddenly been an emergence of sexual abuse. You should hear some of the stories I've heard from decades ago. It is the case that there's been an eruption of people willing to talk about that sexual abuse. Now, what I'm seeing is the pendulum swing opposite of that. What I see now is people hoping, willing to shove it back into that closet. We don't need to talk about it. And I'm saying here, let's not do that. There's a real baby in that bathwater. There really is something for us to keep in the open so that we, even if no one else in the history of the world has done it, at least we can start doing something better than allowing the harm, the pain, to continue, just because we don't want the discomfort of changing our old ways. I know our old ways, and we could do far worse than to change them.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.